Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalam Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Sadnam, Sat Sriyakal, Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanya, Wasayake. Hello, may everything be well with you as it is with me. By way of explanation, for those of you who came last Wednesday, who may have came last Wednesday, we did not hold class. My daughter was suddenly taken ill and had to be transported from her place of work to the hospital. And I thank all of those of you who offered prayers for her and for myself and our family. And God did answer those prayers, and she's going to have her gallbladder out, but other than that, everything is fine. And that's a very routine operation. Thousands and thousands of them are done every day in the United States. So it's a very routine thing and a laparoscopic procedure. So thank you very much for your prayers. But that explains why class was canceled at the last moment. We will continue on today in our teaching and study concerning the concept of devakut, cleaving to God. But before I begin this class, I will do as I do at the beginning of every shiur, and I will recite the Kaddish for the dead and for the mourners of the dead. Please close your eyes as you listen and remember someone to whom you are close who has passed away. Excuse me. In doing so, you will honor that person's life and bless his or her memory with the light of your own consciousness. Baruch Hashem. Yishkadov yishkadash me rabo, bomo divero kirase, viamlik malkase, bakayakon uvyo makon, uvkaya dekol beis Yisrael, baagalo uvizman koryev, veimro amen. Yehesh me rabo mavorak, leolam ule olam ome omayo, yisbarak ve yistabak ve yisparar ve yisramam, ve yisnase ve yishadar ve yisale ve yishalal, smede dukajo beraku, le elo minko berkaso ve shoroso, tushbakoso ve nekamoso, da amiron ve omo ve imro omen. Yehe shloma rabo min shamayo, ve kayim ulenu ve alkol yisrael ve imro omen. O se shalom bimramov, Hu yashe shalom, olenu ve'al kol Yisrael ve'imru amen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me check our recording levels here. We are tending to max them out. I'll turn this down just a little bit here. There, I think that's a lot better. Yes, that is better. All right. Good thing that I check this all the time. They tend to, when you turn the application on, they tend to reset themselves. So I need to always remember to check them. All right. Well, as you know, we've been talking about the concept of devakut, which is the Hebrew word for mystical union, union meaning union with God. It is a psycho-spiritual state. In literally, devakut in Hebrew means clinging to. It also means pursuing hard after. Means union with what? With one of the aspects of God, the Ten Sefirot, which can also be considered, since each one of those has a mystical name of God assigned to it, they can be regarded every bit as much as being an aspect of God, probably even stronger. They can be regarded as a manifestation, one of the ten descending manifestations of God, as God descends from his status of Ein Sof, which is totally unknowable, totally transparent, totally unattainable and incomprehensible by mankind. God lowers himself in the supreme act of humility, lowers his status from that of being purely transcendent and spiritual in 10 stages or manifestations, 10 manifestations coming into the world. until finally he comes into the world as the world itself, the universe, and all of its galaxies and stars and planetary systems, of which one is the one on which we are at that is called Earth. And he is the God over all of Earth and over all of us. He alone is God. There is no other. Okay? And this is what Devakut is all about, is attaining a state of union with either one of God's manifestations into the world of temporality and space and matter, or with God itself in its highest form, ultimately, which would be Keter. That would be in the highest form attainable by mankind. Now, we talked a little bit about that in our last meeting. Today, I want to go into some of the more of the details of what this experience is all about from a Jewish mystical perspective, especially from the perspective of Kabbalah, which existed at least in terms of being written about and known under the terms of Kabbalah, beginning around the year 1000 or 1100 in the Common Era. So we'll talk some more about that now. According to Moshe Idel, a great Jewish scholar, an intellect, really, a great Jewish scholar of Kabbalah, there are three basic types of, or categories, let's put it this way, categories that contain terminology, mystical terminology, describing the experience, the mystic's experience of Devakut in Jewish mysticism. So we have three containers. This is one way to look at it, and the way that Moshe Idel, the great Jewish scholar of Kabbalah, has, is he has said there are three containers in which we can group all the various terms of mystics used to describe the experience of Devakut. Those are Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, and Hermetic. Now, you might notice right away, these are philosophical terms. Yes, that's what he's talking about. Because he makes an argument, and this argument is also made by probably the founder of modern scholarship in terms of Kabbalah, Gershom Scholem. He's no longer with us, blessed be his memory. But he founded the modern study of Kabbalah and really brought to it the rigors of scientific methodology as far as they pertain to social sciences. But both of these individuals, both Gershom Scholem and Moshe Idel, hold that Jewish mysticism was influenced by Western philosophy. And I will include in that, and of course we're talking about coming from Greece, Greek philosophy. And you see that in these names, Aristotelian, in these categories, Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, and Hermetic, of course, that comes later in terms of alchemy. But I will include in this Islamic influences as well, because Islam is really what kept alive the great Greek philosophers and the Greek writings during the Dark Ages of Europe. And then they also had an influence, Islamic philosophers had their own influence on Greek philosophy. And so, you know, really there's no stream of consciousness, no stream of philosophy, religion, or learning that exists entirely in a vacuum. All streams of religion and philosophy and consciousness and spiritualism exist in a soup in a milieu, so to speak here, of dynamic cultural groups and belief systems and I think that describes it. And so there are constant interactions between them, and they all have an impact. They pick up things, they share things, they give things, and they receive things from each other's streams. And so, according to Moshe Edel and Gershom Scholem, Jewish mysticism also drew upon and received ideas from the classic philosophers. And of course, didn't just take them wholeheartedly, but I mean, all alone without making any modification, they adapted them and made them fit into the concepts and contexts of Jewish mysticism up to the time in which they incorporated these classical philosophical concepts. Okay, so Jewish mysticism, and especially the concept, what we're talking about today, the concept of Devakut, was influenced by Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, and Hermetic philosophies. Okay, what do I mean by that? Specifically with respect to Devakut, Aristotelian implies unification of the human intellect with the divine intellect. So it's an intellectual matter. It's the unification of the two intellects, the human and the divine. Neoplatonic indicates unification of the human soul with its root, the divine soul. It holds that all souls, human souls, come from a root, and that root is the divine soul. And Hermetic unification involves the use of descent magic. I'll explain all these things in detail as we go on here. Descent magic to draw down the Ruhaniyat, which means spiritual beings in Hebrew. Ruhaniyat, spiritual beings, with which the mystic, the Kabbalist, experiences mystical union. So instead of the human intellect ascending, see, the first two, Aristotelian, Neoplatonic, have to do with ascension on the part of the human. With Aristotelian, it's the ascent of the human intellect to the Sefira Chokhmah, where it joins with the divine intellect. The Neoplatonic has to do with the ascent of the human soul to its root in the divine soul. And the Hermetic, though, is different. It has to do with descent through the use of magical incantations, the use of magic names. Those procedures are used to draw down spiritual beings, known as Ruhaniyot in Hebrew, which the mystic then experiences mystical union. Okay, let's talk first about the Aristotelian, and that's all we'll have time for today, I'm sure. This is unification of the human intellect with the divine intellect, intellectual union. This occurs, and I'm going to say this slowly because you have to think about this. Okay, it's not immediately easily handled with the mind. This occurs, intellectual union occurs, when a knowing subject, that's you or me, when a knowing subject brings into consciousness, that's our human consciousness, a known object. That means an object that is perceived. That object can be an object literally, like this coffee cup that I have sitting here on my hot plate, or it can be a human being, or it can be anything else, and anything else, anything that we're capable of seeing or hearing or perceiving. When we do that, we bring that object into our consciousness because we have perceived it. Okay, and in this form of Devakut, the Aristotelian form, which is intellectual, our intellectual knowing of the object, that is, bringing it, knowing means bringing it into our consciousness, is a form of unification, because the knower and that which is known, okay, the subject and the object, become one in the intellectual consciousness of the knower. Okay, Edward Edinger, one of the many gifted pupils of the great 20th century theologian and psychologist Carl Gustav Jung, Edward Edinger, one of his students, wrote in his book, the title of which is The Meaning of Consciousness, the following words about what I just described to you. Quote, "The experience of being the knowing subject, however, is only half of the process of knowledge. The other half is the experience of being the known object. The ego," he's referring here to now as to the human ego, okay? "The ego as knower conquers the outer or inner other," in quotes, other, in quotes, "by relegating it to the status of a known object." So the object, before it's perceived, stands on its own, stands alone on its own. It's a separate entity, separate from us. We don't perceive it. We have not yet perceived it. But when we perceive it, and it comes into our consciousness, we experience it. We experience the perception of the object that is being transmitted to us through one or more of our five sense organs, eyes, ears, mouth, nose, etc., touch. Okay? We experience it, and it becomes a part of us. But that's only half the experience of knowing, Edward Edinger tells us. And this is based on his learning from Jung. He says that the other half is the experience of being the known object. That means that the known object, whether it's sentient or not, has an experience when we bring it into our consciousness. And that other half, that experience is the other half of the total experience of knowing. Okay? The great master himself, Jung, see Carl Gustav Jung, in his masterwork, Answer to Job, and it's truly a masterwork. I recommend everybody hearing this to get a copy of it. It's not very much money. You can get it from Amazon. The book is titled Answer to Job. Jung said, and this is just key to this whole concept of consciousness and what we're teaching on here about Devakut, "Existence is only real when it is conscious to somebody. That is why the Creator needs conscious man, even though from sheer unconsciousness he would like to prevent him from becoming conscious." Okay, what does that mean? Let's read it again and I'll explain. "Existence is only real when it is conscious to somebody." So that means that the object that I just talked about, that was being written about by Edward Edinger, the known object that prior to its coming into the consciousness of the knowing subject stands alone because it has not yet been perceived. What Jung is saying is that existence for such an object is only real at the moment it becomes conscious to somebody. So let's say that I look out there and I see a tree with some birds on it, some crows, say. They may indeed have been there prior to my seeing them. This would be as an objective other, right? However, their existence is only real And we can get into the semantics of what real means if we wish, but I'm going to skip over that today. I'm going to say subjectively real. When it is becomes conscious to somebody else, to an other, it takes two. There is a transaction of consciousness here that Jung is talking about, and it takes two to tango. There is a knowing subject and a known object. And the reality of the known object exists only when it becomes known to, it comes into, it means coming into the consciousness of the knowing subject. Okay, and then he goes on to say, it's for that reason that the Creator, and he's referring now to God. Yes, Jung believed absolutely in God. And he is saying here, that is why the Creator needs conscious man, even though from sheer unconsciousness, whose unconsciousness? He's talking about God. That's one of the main premises of Jung in his master work titled Answer to Job. It's one of the main premises is that God starts out as unconscious, just as man start who is made in God's image and likeness starts out as unconscious, and then down through history more and more consciousness comes into the world. And that means into man's mind, into his collective and into his collective consciousness, his individual consciousness, and also into his collective unconscious, which means the divine mind of God. So Jung says that is why the fact that existence is only real and when it becomes conscious to an other, to someone else, he says that is why the Creator needs conscious man, even though from sheer unconsciousness, God would like to prevent him from becoming conscious. Now remember, in Genesis, what happens when man becomes conscious? Do you remember when man becomes conscious? When is that? It's when Adam and Hava eat from the forbidden tree. They eat from the tree of what? The tree of knowledge of good and evil. And it says, after they eat from this tree, the fruit of this tree, that it's as if their eyes are opened. Actually, it says literally, their eyes are opened. And they become conscious that they are naked. Before this time, they were not conscious of everything. They were special beings. They were shielded by God from having to know too much. From having to be aware of what? Well, the fruit they ate was from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So it was the knowledge of good and evil that God tried to protect mankind from. But Adam and Hava ate of the tree, and their eyes were opened, and they became aware of what? The conflict of opposites, good and evil. That's what they became aware of. They gained the knowledge of the conflicts of all the opposites in where? In themselves. Because they took this knowledge, they ate of this tree, so they took this knowledge into themselves. Mankind now had within himself the opposites of good and evil, light and darkness, male and female, sun, moon, night, day, love, apathy, loving kindness, wrath. All of these opposites are now in man. And by being in man, they are now in the world. And where did they come from? Well, they came from God. They came from the tree that God planted in the garden. They came from God. God made everything. We are a monotheistic religion. In fact, it was Abraham who, that was his great insight. That was the greatest discovery of all time. All time. Was the discovery by man that God is not many, but God is one. And so if God is one, then that means that everything in the world was made by God and comes from God. In fact, God says that. He says, I make good, I make evil. I alone do all these things. I'm paraphrasing now a verse from the scripture. anyway. So Jung says that existence is only real when it is conscious to somebody else. And that's why the Creator needs conscious man. Let me give you an example that describes this in real terms, okay? I'm going to give you a biblical example out of Exodus chapter 3. You will recognize this. This is when, that's the burning bush episode, when Moses sees God. And God gives Moses his mission. I'm going to read from chapter 3, beginning with verse 1. Moses was looking after the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led it to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, just for those of you who might be wondering about this, Horeb is another name, another biblical name for Mount Sinai. Okay, so Mount, or as some people call it, Mount Sinai, which I believe the correct pronunciation is Mount Sinai, is another name for that is Mount Horeb. It's the mountain of God. It's the same mountain to which Moses is going to lead the Israelites after they've been freed from Egypt. He's going to lead them through the desert and take them to the same mountain. It's called, again, even though it's called Mount Sinai in later on, it's also referred to as the mountain of God. So this is God's mountain. This is the point at which God can be encountered by humans, by mankind. Okay, so it says that Moses led his father-in-law's flock of sheep far into the desert. In fact, he led it to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Verse 2, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame blazing from the middle of a bush. Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I must go across and see this strange sight, and why the bush is not being burned up. Verse 4, when the Lord saw that Moses turned aside to look, God called to him, Moses, from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, here I am. Moses answered, come no nearer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. I am the God of your ancestors, he said, the God of Abraham, the God of Yitzhak, the God of Yaakov. At this, Moses covered his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Now, this is the incident that starts the ball rolling, leading all the way up to modern times. In the next verses, God gives Moses his mission of bringing the children of Israel out from bondage in Egypt. And when Moses asks God what name he should give to the elders of the Israelites as the God who is redeeming them, God answers in verse 14 of chapter 3 of Exodus. And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Okay, that's Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. Now, that's the translation most often rendered. The Hebrew is Eya Asher Eya, or it's okay to pronounce that as Eya Asher Eya. I like to emphasize that letter hey there. Literally, it can be translated several ways. The one that I like is this. I am happy that I am. I am happy that I am. That's a really strange thing for God to say to Moses when he says, what is your name? And it tells us in those verses right there that God says that this shall be the name that you shall know me, that you shall call on me with forever. I am happy that I am. Well, this is about as clear statement as one can find that the interaction between God and Moses is for God, from God's perspective, a proof of God's very existence. Now, before you start leaving the room, before you start writing me off as a raving maniac, I want you to think about it for a moment. God is HaKol, the All. We all agree on that. There is nothing else except God. God is one. Therefore, God is alone within itself, everywhere. God is all and everywhere. No one else. No other. God alone. There would be no way, under such circumstances, for God to determine the reality of its own existence, its own self-existence. Perhaps, God might think, my existence is nothing more than the delusion of a lunatic or the dream of a sleeping child. How can I know for sure? Think about it. If you were the only one who existed, if you were the only human being, and you were everywhere, there was nothing outside of you. Indeed, you had no boundaries. There were no boundaries to your being. You were all and everywhere. You would not be able to determine the reality of your own existence. This is the situation I maintain that God, and N. Jung maintains, that God found itself in prior to the creation of the universe and mankind. This question, meaning the reality of his own existence, would torment God throughout eternity because God is eternal. It would be relief from the torment of that question that God would then have another thought. And that thought would be, I know I will create a universe with a planet called Earth, and I will create another being called man. And I will appear on a high mountain in the wilderness of that planet in the form of a burning thorn bush, but one that does not consume, the fire does not consume. And I will see if any of these humans that I have made, as they grow in population upon this planet called Earth, answers my calling. If one does, then truly I must exist. Now, we don't know, because it doesn't tell us in the written Torah, which I just read to you, why Moses, who was out in the far edge of the desert and came upon this mountain called Horeb, why he decided to leave the sheep down at the bottom of the mountain and climb that mountain. We're not told what was in Moses' mind. But I maintain that God was calling even then. He was calling out to anyone who had ears to hear him. And I'm not talking about physical ears. I'm talking about spiritual ears. Ears in one's heart. And Moses experienced the spiritual calling of God coming from up on that mountain. And he said, I need to climb that mountain. He probably didn't even know why he was climbing that mountain. He just knew he had to climb that mountain. So he did. He climbed that mountain and he came upon this bush. Now, my teacher, great Kabbalist, Yaakov Leib HaKohen, taught that the burning thorn bush has been on God's mountain forever, burning away, but not being consumed by the flame within, which was God's angel. And he maintains that many men passed within its sight over the millennia. But of all those men, it was only Moses who saw the bush and said, oh, what is this strange sight? I must go up to it and find out. What is this bush that burns and yet is not consumed? Only Moses. Because this is the sorting out in fulfillment of cosmic and divine and human destiny, of which all three are intertwined. And it was only when God, in the form of it was only when God, in the form of that burning bush, was experienced as an object by Moses. Only when God called out, Moshe, Moshe, from the midst of the bush, and Moses answered, Hineni, Lord, your servant is listening, that the reality of God's existence was objectively confirmed to God. Let me check the time that we have right now, see if... I've gone on long enough. I'm trying to cut these down from around 50 minutes and 45 minutes and get them down to under 35 minutes. So this is a good stopping place, and we'll continue on this on Wednesday. But I want you to think about what I've been teaching on today. Ask yourself, if you were all alone and you had no boundaries to you had no physical self. In other words, there were no boundaries either in time or space to you. How would you be able to tell if you existed, if your existence was real? Ask yourself that. Think about that. And think about the method that God used to confirm his existence. So that when another, somebody, yes, that God had to create, within the womb of creation, where the universe exists, even today, came up to him and answered the call, Moshe, Moshe. And Moses answered, Hineni, Lord, your servant is listening. Only then could God know that he existed. And what was his response when Moses asked him for his name? It was, Heya Asher Heya, I am happy that I am. I am happy that I am. He's essentially saying, I am glad to know that I exist. All right, that's all we're going to teach on today. We'll continue along this vein, in this direction, on Wednesday. In the meantime, this has been recorded and will be available later this evening on our website at www.templebeitshemtov. Press the button on the navigation bar for audio archives, and later this evening you'll be able to download this as an MP3 file. And also, if you don't wish to do that, you can come back and listen to this again. We'll be rebroadcasting the same teaching tonight in the same room, same place, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Pacific Time. In the meantime, I ask for God's blessing to be upon you. May you go from strength to strength. Be well. Zygesund.